PFAS have become a very hot topic for the food industry and consumer advocacy groups. But just what are these substances? What are they used for? And why are they so controversial? I am your TAG Talks host, Lisa Lupo, and today I'm talking with TAG Director of Food Safety, Brent Koblish, about this hot topic. Good afternoon, Brent.
Good afternoon, Lisa. Great to be with you.
Yes, it's good to have you. So today we are discussing PFAS, but what exactly are they and where might they be being used?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it certainly sparked a lot of interest in the toxicological space, the food safety space, et cetera, ever since probably the early 2000s. But, you know, more recently, it's gained a lot of notoriety in water, et cetera, such that they're called forever chemicals because of their persistence in the environment. They don't break down very easily. So how do we manage these chemicals? Well, PFAS are a group of perfluoroalkyl substances, and we know of around 9,000 of these compounds. And so it's hard to lump them all into one category. You can do that chemically, but toxicologically, these 9,000 compounds have differing levels of toxicity, you know, some more toxic than others. And so lumping them all into one group really cannot be done from a toxicological standpoint, but I understand why that they're lumped into this group. But more importantly, they've been used since around the 1940s or 1950s. It started to get widespread use in things like nonstick cookware and really providing a surface chemistry for a number of even fabrics mitigate things like oils and spills and these types of things. They're very effective of that. In the food packaging industry, you know, I talked about nonstick cookware, but in the food packaging industry, traditionally these have been used as nonstick and grease-proofing agents for any foods that are greasy or overtly fatty, oily, these types of things, so that the product and the oils don't bleed through the packaging so that the integrity of the packaging can be maintained. So they've been used at low levels in a number of food packaging instances for many, many years to provide that integrity and that grease proofing for the packaging itself.
Okay. So what are some of the complications that manufacturers face in packaging changes and regulatory compliance of these substances?
Well, from a regulatory compliance standpoint, you have a number of agencies that regulate different parts of potentially the food supply, including water. You know, that EPA has set a number of advisory levels, most recently, last month, where they lowered the level of certain PFAS compounds, perfluoroalkanoic acid being one of those, and they've lowered the advisory level in water for some of these compounds because it can leach into the groundwater and end up in the water, et cetera. The FDA obviously will regulate a large part of this of the food supply, obviously. And they also regulate things like packaging materials, and there's a number of perfluoroalkyl substances that are approved for use in packaging materials in the Code of Federal Regulations. However, what we're seeing is individual states, much like similarly as the industry dealt with the GMO issue or the genetically modified organism issue, you have a number of different states that are starting to regulate these PFAS compounds. For instance, California, come next year in 2023, has banned the use of PFAS in any packaging material. Now, they don't specify which PFAS, they just say PFAS. So fluorinated compounds that are used in packaging are going to be banned. This follows other bans and other regulations found in Minnesota, Connecticut, and a whole host of other states. And so what you have is a piecemeal regulatory framework that's going to be very difficult for industry and packaging suppliers, et cetera, to manage. And so what do you do? You know, one of the things you can do is, in some cases, you're going to have to get out of it and find alternatives. So what we saw with bisphenol A in epoxy coatings and these types of things, finding an alternative isn't as easy as just switching on a light or turning off a light. A lot of times it requires, and most of the time requires, significant R&D discovery to identify suitable alternatives. Because like I said in the previous question, they have significant benefit in not only protecting the food from the packaging itself, but maintaining the integrity of that packaging such that it can get to the consumer space without bleeding through the packaging and then you have packaging falling apart, et cetera. So just finding an alternative may be easy for one commodity and not another commodity because there's different acidities, different basic, because perfluoroalkyl substances are very heat resistant too. Okay. And so they have a lot of chemical characteristics that have been, because they've been used to good purpose for a number of different commodities and food products across a whole spectrum. But an alternative may be good for one area, not another. I don't know the technical aspect very well, because I'm not a packaging expert per se, but I can imagine based on my career and being involved in, you know, the BPA saga and the ongoing saga with that, and finding alternatives is not just as easy as is waving a magic wand and then there you go. So there's going to be considerable amount of effort identifying suitable alternatives. But then also when we talk about sustainability too, so this gets into other aspects that are important for companies in selling their products. Obviously, sustainability is a big one that affects corporations. Is, can you use, when you do recycled paperboard and recycle product, is it appropriate to continue to recycle that because of the nature of these perfluoroalkyl substances? They don't break down. And so if it ends up in water and you're using that water to wash packaging from a recycled paperboard standpoint, are you now introducing very low amounts of perfluoroalkyl substances in that paperboard when you're washing it? So there's different avenues by which these perfluoroalkyl substances can impact packaging and find their way into foods, not just water, not just in the soil from the farm level, but also from the packaging. So there's a lot of areas to manage these compounds, and at levels that, quite frankly, what we're seeing with the EPA advisory limits aren't even detectable, some of those, using even the most advanced analytical techniques, even in water. So it's causing considerable heartburn. And I think there's a lot of corporations that may be unaware that these things are starting to be regulated, started to garner a lot of attention. And I think they really need to get their arms wrapped around it sooner than later.
Yeah, so it really sounds like compliance with some of these new regulations that are being introduced could be rather difficult. So absolutely, what are some of the things that maybe the food businesses should start doing now? You mentioned a couple, but what are some other things that they can be doing now to help ensure both safety and that they are complying?
Well, I think, you know, as we talk about risk, and when I talk about risk, I talk about it in three avenues, each in order. Safety is of the utmost importance, obviously. Right. Then regulatory compliance, and then quality impacts to your products, et cetera, that impact your brands as well. But from a safety standpoint, the science is still evolving. There's a lot of advisory levels from 2016. And what we've seen here with the EPA reducing those levels, some of those reduction in levels, advisory levels, are 13,000 fold below what they advised in 2016. So the science and the toxicological sciences is continuing to evolve. So what can you do? Ultimately, if the FDA finds, you know, and they're doing market basket surveys, they're testing a whole host of products to ensure the safety of the supply chain. The best thing you can do is start monitoring these levels
in your
supply chain, and then proactively determining risk. and calculating risk based on exposure levels, based on the hazard, based on the type of PFAS that you found in your product. Because like I said earlier, you know, some of these can have orders of magnitude difference in toxicology. So they're not all created equal. So taking a proactive approach of monitoring and risk assessment will set you set yourself up to communicate the risk or lack thereof as it pertains to your products. Next, as we move into the regulatory compliance, you know, some of these laws are written where it's almost, it has to be absent. It can't be, you cannot find it. So what do? You have to find alternatives. I think right now, as I hesitate saying this, because there's very few instances where you have to press the proverbial red button to make changes, I think this is a space where you have a number of states coming on board. And certainly internationally, there might be regulations that you need to be concerned about, probably in the EU. So if you're a global organization, you need to start addressing these concerns because these compounds are ubiquitous. And so if you can identify it, are you in compliance with the state or federal regulations that are seeking to remove or ban or significantly reduce the levels that have been traditionally found in your products? And so getting your arms around that and from a toxicological standpoint, from a government affairs, from a regulatory compliance standpoint is very important. And then quality, ensuring that any alternatives you find are going to meet and or exceed the quality expectations that your consumers are also concerned about. You know, no consumer wants to make a product in the microwave only to pull that product out and the grease and stuff just melts right through the packaging,
right?
You know, and it ends up on the floor. And so there's significant quality concerns that a number of these manufacturers are going to have to consider, you know, as a whole. But first, to start with the safety, regulatory compliance, and move into quality. And, you know, like I've said before, and what we've talked about at TAG, you know, it takes an army in terms of expertise to appropriately identify an alternative and the path forward specific to your company. And so involving your packaging suppliers, involving suppliers of ingredients, et cetera, to understand what may be coming into the doors to make your finished product is important. And there's no easy, you know, one step, one size fits all approach to this, but taking proactive and getting serious about these compounds is far from it needs to be addressed, right? The regulations are going in that direction, so it behooves organizations to get involved and start identifying these alternatives.
All right, thank you so much, Brent. You really kind of exposed a lot about PFAS, and you know, we hopefully our listeners have learned a lot about it and what can be done. And we do have further information on PFAS on a number of articles on TAG's Insights page on our webpage, or feel free to call on Brent or any of our army of experts, as Brent so well put it, and for any questions or assistance. And as always, be sure to click subscribe to stay up to date on all things food safety and public health from your TAG experts. Thank you, Brent.
You're welcome, Lisa. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.